Just to let you know, Vox Talks Economics is one of the finalists for the 2025 Signal Awards, which honour the best podcasts worldwide.
So please join other listeners in voting for us using the link that we'll put in the show notes.
And tell your friends about us too. Today on Vox Talks Economics, does where we live still shape our tastes? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Now, every week we bring you the best, the most interesting new research in economics. So remember, follow us wherever you get your podcasts, you find us there. Follow us on Instagram as well at Vox Talks Economics. Now, it's a cultural meme that teenagers in New York and Seoul will have more in common with each other than they do with their parents. So has where we live been downgraded as an influence on what we like? Or is there still what my guest today calls gravity in tastes? His research focuses on a very important aspect of this question to many of us, regional French food. Thierry Maillet of Sciences Po and CEPR is that expert. He joins me now. Thierry, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Thierry, why is it that regions in countries like France, many other countries as well, have different types of food that locals identify as their food, their own?
The main hypothesis that economists have, together with people that are more specialists of history and sociologists, I'll get back to sociology quite a lot actually in this work, is that initially, like a long, long, long time ago, with very high trade costs, even inside countries where it's very hard to travel and to actually move goods, there's a predominance of regional variation in climatic and suitability of the land for different type of agricultural production and therefore food. And that means that you got a comparative advantage of doing a certain type of good on a specific kind of area because it is flat and very fertile, or on the contrary, it's mountainous and it has different climates. I'm also a trade economist, so that generates comparative advantage, which is relative price differentials. And of course, such differentials, they favor local consumption. And so, of course, when you live somewhere in the north where climate can be pretty rough, there's not much vegetables and fruits in general in your diet simply because there's not a lot that you can grow. And why is that still relevant, even in the 1970s, which is the first period that we look at, is through early life habit formation and transmitted through vertical transmission by the parents.
I hope that many of the people listening to this will have had a chance to experience the diversity of French regional food. But just to remind them or to inform anyone else, what examples of foods could you give me that traditionally are strongly linked to one region in France?
So one of the most famous, because it was brought by many, many historians, actually Fernand Braudel even made it one of the prime examples, was that there was a France of olive oil and France of butter. So long, long, long time ago, there was actually data being collected as what is the share of oil and olive oil in particular versus butter and the type of fats that you're using to actually cook. And of course, the olive oil is more prevalent in the southeast where you can actually grow olive trees and butter is in the northwest. That's a really famous example. Also, vegetables have much higher share in the overall consumption basket of the south of the country. And in particular, cheese is very high in the mountainous areas compared to the rest of the country. Something we can study with the type of data we had is alcohol consumption.
Right.
Overall, alcohol consumption is quite a lot stronger historically in the north of France compared to the south of France, to the rest of France. But also, and that is another very well-known thing, is the types of alcohol differ a lot, but really a lot. Normandy is very specialized in consumption of cider, way more than anywhere else in France. France is known as a wine consumption and wine production, but actually in the north of France, near Lille, there's a predominance of beer compared to wine, which is quite different.
It's quite distracting talking about this, but we have to stay on topic. Now, you did mention that there is also this intergenerational transmission of taste, that it's not just all about availability and price, that we also tend to like things because our parents liked it.
Yeah. As an economist, what's interesting is to take sort of the knowledge accumulated by other type of hard science. So typically, the taste is something acquired very, very early, even inside your mother's womb. So this is very well known that kids in India are born with a different type of taste for spicy food or for spice in general than anywhere else in the world, because it transits through the mother. So you acquire taste by tasting things very early on, a little bit like you acquire languages very early on, because your brain and your cells in general are much more flexible for the first years. But then, of course, there's something interesting where economics is more helpful in a sense, that there's something endogenous. So when you acquire this taste, then it's hard to change it. It actually takes a long time to change it. Uh-huh. Even if you migrate, it's going to take a generation to actually change your habits. And therefore, you have your other kids even in other areas, and you transmit that taste simply because you cook the same way as you were cooked by your own parents. And sometime, and that's also something that economists can actually shed light on, there's a voluntary will by parents to actually transmit their cultural trait, and they make efforts to do it, despite the fact that it's costly. That is, if I'm an Italian and I come to France, let's say, it looks very similar cuisine, but Italians would completely disagree with that. And so they will make actually efforts to find the real pasta or the real mozzarella or the real wine, of course. Mm-hmm. And that is more costly in France for plenty of reasons because of transport goods. But still, you make that conscious effort, which is something you do observe. So this vertical transmission is quite strong. Countering that is a horizontal transmission in the sense that you mix with people in school, you mix with people in university and jobs, and they have different cultural tastes than you, but just if only by random chance. And so there's this horizontal transmission, but people essentially travel not very far in terms of migration. And migrants, as I said, adapt their consumption very slowly, which means that those things tend to be very slow. The diffusion of cultural tend to be quite slow over space.
We're talking about food, and I note drink today, and I'm delighted we are, but can this principle, this localism principle, can it be applied to other things as well?
That's why we use the expression of a gravity in taste,
right?
Because it relates to a gravity equation in trade in general, and in economics in general, that sort of describes this tendency of flows to be very local and very much affected by distance. But not only distance, also borders of many, many, many kinds. And that, of course, applies to food, but that applies to a lot of different goods. So prime examples are, of course, any other good or service with strong cultural content. There's quite a literature, actually, in cultural economics that looks at flows of music, pop music in particular. Joe Waldfogel from Minnesota published several papers looking at the impact of national borders and the distance and found this to be big and not going down, which is another thing interesting, is that those sort of home bias in tastes that creates a less trade across border or across space than they should be according to a perfectly integrated world, they tend to be quite persistent, and sometimes they go down, but sometimes they're actually not going down at all.
Well, we'll look at the persistence in these tastes in a second.
Europe's social changes are also reflected in the way we vote. In our episode, Economic Decline and the Rise of Populism, from May 2024, Andrés Rodríguez-Posay explains how increasing regional inequality is redrawing Europe's political map. Listen to this and all our past episodes when you follow Vox Talks Economics wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Thierry, you used French expenditure surveys to discover if this gravity that you've been describing has weakened over time. So between which years have you done this research? What sort of expenditure have you tracked?
It is the National Household Expenditure Survey that the French National Statistical Institute is running. It's running it about every 5 years. The surveys we took and kept are the ones from 1974 and the one from 2005. The idea being that first, in order for us to look at whether the gravity in a cross-section of the data in a given year had evolved over time, we wanted to have enough time lag for this thing to take place. Second, we wanted to have data where we could estimate in the first stage a demand estimation, so a demand side regression. And therefore, we needed quantities and prices. And those two ones had prices that were readily available inside. And so we could actually run those regressions. Those surveys are about 15,000 households, 10,000 households. It's actually a survey that is run every 5 years. And it takes about 8 waves, 6 weeks each over an entire year to run those things.
Well, this sounds like excellent data, but were you able to track particular products in this, or are you looking at very broad categories of food?
The advantage is that it goes back in the past as much as we wanted. The disadvantage is that we are only able to work with broad categories.
Okay.
And that's very different, for instance, to scanner type data that we see a lot now is used in this literature, but that's very recent data. You can't really come back and say, okay, this is a pack of Coke or this is a precise brand of cheese. We have 9 broad categories. So alcohol, dairy products, drinks, fats, fruits, grains, meats, and prepared products and vegetables. That's our 9 broad categories. And you see prepared products, of course, is something that is big and it's bigger over time. There's a second level that we use for some of the analysis that has 47 goods inside those 9 categories. So typically dairy is cheese, cream, milk, and yogurt. So that's what we can do to get this sort of depth of time, like a sufficient time period.
So let's first of all go back to 1974, the first wave of the survey that you analyze. How strong is gravity in tastes in 1974?
Let me try to express it as an elasticity. Essentially, what we're doing is we're looking at the regression we're running, try to quantify that, is that we first estimate a particular taste for a particular category in a particular département, which is one of the 90s areas of administrative boundaries of France. And then we calculate the distance between this taste, okay, between two departments. So it's a matrix of a bilateral taste difference. And we regress this on a set of fixed effects, of course, but also on geographic distance, the pure geographic distance between those two places inside France. And we find that 10% increase in distance is associated with a 1.4% increase in taste difference across both years, but with a very strong difference between 74 and 2005. It's 2.1% in 74 and 0.8 in 2005.
That's a big difference.
France is flattening in a sense. The geography and the impact of distance is going down over time. There's more integration.
So what's happening between 1974 and 2005 that would flatten France in this way?
In the paper, you can find some interesting maps of what actually are the natural potential causes of this flattening. So one has to do with transport cost infrastructure. So essentially in 1974, there was not a lot of motorways inside France, actually. So the first motorway is post-World War II. And the rate of progress in building those motorways in France has been quite slow until the 70s. So we're only at the very beginning. And the motorways are essentially like a Paris to Marseille, Paris to Lille, and a little bit to Normandy, but that's it in the 70s. In 2005, the country is completely integrated in terms of a motorway network. So that's a big change, together with tremendous progress in high-speed train. So this first transport costs are falling. And that, of course, is going to integrate the market because it's going to integrate and tend to provide a homogenization in prices, which is exactly what we find in the data. There's a gradient in price differences that is spatial in that is related to distance in 74, and it's not there anymore in 2005.
I see. So this price gradient disappears. Does this mean that the geographical distance is less of an influence on tastes in 2005 than it was in 1974, because that's what we would expect, I guess.
Yes. So why we're able to actually talk about tastes and preference is that because in the demand estimation, we're actually, of course, controlling for price. Uh-huh. So each of those tastes for a particular good, let's say a taste of the South for fruits, is controlling for the fact that it's cheaper in the South than in the North. So this thing we're controlling for. And so the remainder, in a sense, it's a residual approach, of course, is the preference. Something that even at a high price, you want to consume something must be because it's somewhere in your preference. And the integration of those preferences, there are two other potential explanations. First is that there's a huge development of supermarkets over the territory, in the sense that the mass market retail industry has been essentially since the 70s, mm-hmm. the very first one at the end of the 60s. And the logistics around those big supermarkets is making it, again, easier to just find different varieties of a good that could not be found very easily or at a super expensive price. So that's the second potential explanation. Another one, which we contemplated and is also related to sociologists' work, is mass media. Over that period, is essentially 1974, people had the TV, of course, but not everybody had the TV first. And the development of the abundance of TVs and then followed by internet, etc., makes it way easier to broadcast general advertisement, for instance, for a particular mm-hmm. good, which is going to hit a national market share way easier.
So it's now possible by 2005 to see some advertising for some southern food if you're living in the north of France, and you could go to Carrefour and you could see it, and it doesn't cost that much more as if you were going into Carrefour in Nice. I could see how that would weaken gravity. Does that mean that tastes in France become homogenous?
So we look at this fact that distance is less important. And the first thing is that, okay, we've become a homogeneous country. Everybody consumes the same thing. But that's actually not true at all. The fact that distance is less important doesn't mean that the tastes are the same. It just means that they're explained by some other difference.
Uh-huh.
And that space is less important. And so in 2005, what we showed is that actually the overall taste diversity is not that different in 2005 than in 1974. No systematic decrease in the standard deviations of the taste difference across categories typically. And so that tells you that something else has superseded, in a sense, geography in the determination of tastes.
So this is fascinating. What is explaining in 2005 this variation that you have found, if we cannot anymore rely on the natural explanation that has been there for centuries?
The three co-authors, so José de Souza and F. Colson Sierra, the three of us who had worked on cultural economics before, that was borrowing a lot of sociology, was to like, uh-huh. Okay, let's look at what sociologists and political scientists say about that. And they're essentially documenting, sometimes in a qualitative way, sometimes more quantitative, that there's an increased variance in taste and lifestyle in an economy in general. There's a lot of evidence of that. And the idea is that this divide could be linked to social cultural characteristics. And so the typical suspects that sociologists and political scientists put together is, what about education? What about occupation? Mm-hmm. What about national origin?
Yeah.
There's three things that we can look at, that we can measure in the data, is that maybe geography, but its physical distance, has less of an influence. But maybe now it's socioeconomic class, to say, maybe a tainted word, but mm-hmm. just all uses a lot. That could be the main explanation. And so the way we wanted to put that hypothesis to a test is that we constructed the distances in education and distances of occupation across diets. So that's essentially, the measurement is very simple. It's called Manhattan distance. So it's essentially looking at the shares of inside a department of the population that has a certain degree and the differences in those shares. And then you sum those differences in absolute value, and that gives you the Manhattan distance. It's often used measuring social sciences. And we found indeed that those sociocultural differences were better at explaining what happens in 2005 than geography, which was almost actually dead in 2005. So that was education and occupation. We also did national origin with the different census in France. In each of those departments, we can measure the share of people that were born with a certain citizenship.
Right.
And so you can actually look at that also, which obviously could affect things, because in an area where you got a lot of people historically that were born in Germany, or an area where a lot of people were born from Algeria, it might just impact their taste, because they come again with their own tastes that takes a long time to actually dissipate and getting more uniform. And we added a fourth one, also coming from sociology, which is differences in first names, which is often used.
Right. And differences in first names explains what? What is that a proxy for?
There's a very old literature in sociology, and with a really interesting debate for those of you interested in the history of thought, social sciences. There's a very interesting debate between American sociologists and French sociologists, inspired by Bourdieu, about what names really mean as cultural objects, sort of a pure cultural object, because not affected by a price. There's no price of the name Tim compared to the first name Thierry in any dimension. And therefore, it's like a pure cultural object that says something about your preference. And the fact that you want to transmit a name that has either a religious content or a national content, or wants to say something about the fact that you love American movies and you want to give a first name or a singer, right, et cetera, is telling something about culture. That's something that would say, okay, this is like something that tells you, on top of everything, on top of your education, maybe you have something in common with the people somewhere else in the country that call their kids with the same type of name. So in order not to give caricature names, let's say there was a very big wave during this period of short names for baby girls that would end with an A. So Lola, Emma, etc. So there's a very, very strong wave. And so you can measure those differences in shares. And again, that gives you an idea of how similar is the naming patterns. And it follows a little bit the same pattern, actually, is that the Emma and Lola and the Mateo and all those things used to be in the South, because they were sort of imported from Spain and Italy, etc. And they would diffuse not too much. But currently, they're all over the place and they respond more to, again, socioeconomic characteristics. So that was one interesting thing to look at.
So now we have this breakdown in the gravity measured by distance. You have replaced it with these very interesting socio-cultural distances. So can you take us into some households in 1974 and 2005 and use that to explain a little bit about what we might see in terms of people's tastes for food, which is where we started with this?
Maybe you can visualize, like, okay, if you go in a specific area, a specific village or a city somewhere in France in 1974, and you would enter at dinner time the house of a lawyer and the house of somebody working in a manufacturing, you know, plants, they would actually have very similar things on the table.
Right.
They would actually have the same share of different items in terms of vegetables and meat and dairy, etc. And the type of drinks they would have would be very similar compared to somewhere else at 500 kilometers away, where both the lawyer and the worker would also have similar things together, but very different in terms of space. That's 1974. The basket of what you consume and what you eat at dinner and at breakfast is telling you more about where you live than who you are in terms of your jobs and education. And essentially what our research shows is that it has drastically changed over 30 years. Now you take two lawyers, one in Aix-en-Provence and one in Rennes, and they will tend to have the same sort of basket of consumption, and two manufacturing workers also, but now the divide is much less geographical and much more like the employment or the occupation.
I know a lot of people, both within France and outside of France, care very passionately about the culture of French food and French regional food. Should they be concerned by what you have discovered here?
There might be a ground for concern. Think about, is there a rationale to try to protect the regionality of the food? If there's less production and less variety than there used to be, it doesn't mean that it's a problem. Maybe it's just because the preferences of people change and there's not much. That's where economists would say, well, we don't want to change the preferences of people. The preferences of people are the preferences of people. Mm-hmm. But the cause for concern is a little bit like other cultural goods. Let's take the example of French movies. You might want to subsidize those despite the fact that there's low attendance because there is some type of external returns to that. The fact that you subsidize a lot of small movies with small attendance helps you sustain an ecosystem of movie production that is something that at some point might yield a high success or might yield a nouvelle vague or something like that. So it's like an option value in a sense. And also the fact that in the preferences of the French consumer and maybe of the local consumer, there is some value of having this local thing that is defining a little bit their identity. And here, going back to what not only economists, but also sociologists are saying, that really might be a part of their identity, which in economists' word is part of their utility. So there's only a concern if we are worried that this positive external effect might go away because it can be washed out by homogenized food. And I'm not talking here about health. There's also, of course, a completely different literature that tells you that homogenization might be a bad thing because you sort of have low-priced bad food. I'm not talking about that here, but about like the pure diversity. Maybe it is a good thing to have 300 or 500 type of cheese in France per se because it's raising diversity and people like the diversity.
Yes, in this conversation, we are talking about food, but we're also not talking about food, aren't we? And I guess the other question about this is, should people who are very concerned about regional identity, cultural divides in society, whatever their opinions about it, should they be taking note of your research here?
It goes a little bit beyond my research, but I would say that there is something here that speaks to the debate about how the attachment to your territory in how different classes of people living in a certain territory feel about the attachment and how local they feel. So indeed, if now the consumption basket of food is, of course, only one of the aspects, so we document this also with the surnames, if now the type of identity you're expressing is more a matter of where you went to university or what type of occupation you have, then you have less in common with people from different backgrounds, but that live in the same city as you, that might not help generate like consensus locally to arrive at some good decisions locally. So I think it speaks to that kind of less mixing of population locally. Yann Algan, in one of his papers, he was arguing that there's the end of those cafes, all those places where people would go every single evening and enjoy some wine or some beer and talk and be of different backgrounds. This has gone essentially, or it's less so. That actually might be a bad social thing, but I'm just an economist, so I don't have much to say about that, except that, yes, that it speaks to that debate.
It is a fascinating debate. I, for one, am still delighted that there are still 500 varieties of French cheese, and I hope that one day I will have tried all of them. Meanwhile, Thierry, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you very much, Tim.
The discussion paper is discussion paper 20563 at CPR. It is called Tastes, Geography and Culture. The authors are Yves Colson-Sira, José de Souza and Thierry Maillet.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week on Vox Talks Economics, the economic cost of biological invasions.